Thank you so much for being here and sharing your stories today. I am part of a knitting group, and we sometimes can bring projects to the group and get help with them. And I'm wondering if there are things that you guys like, blankets or scarves or hats or socks or anything that you would be interested in receiving from our group.
Yes, and I'll just tell you a very brief story that just this year, back in maybe September, October, we received a phone call from a woman whose voice was so distorted that I thought, in fact, it was Dennis calling me, just kidding around. But I realized it wasn't. This woman said she too was a knitter and that she had some beanies that she wanted to share with the community, and would I come and pick them up? And so I did, and I was greeted by this woman whose hands really are gnarled like this, who had just the previous year had a pretty severe stroke, and it had caused her to not be able to talk and caused her to not be able to walk very well. But she said she could still knit, and she wanted to do something for the field workers that she'd see when she'd drive from appointment to appointment out in the fields. And she knew that what she could contribute were knitted hats. So she actually donated. It ended up being about 50 knitted caps. So every December, we have posadas that we host at the Catholic Worker House. And so I knew that these caps would be passed out then because it's typically very, very cold. So I make an announcement, and I share this woman's story with all of the field worker families. And they were precious. And so they wanted to, during the prayers of petition, it wasn't one, it was 10 different people offering prayers for her, for gratitude, for her willingness to share with them, you know, their lives. So, yes, we really pretty much accept anything. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, beanies, blankets, scarves, any of that would be certainly appreciated.
I just was going to say, there are some items on the table over here. So we are strangers to some of you. We know a lot of you, but there are some people we don't know. we do a quarterly newsletter. So I brought the last one, and it's on the table. If you just want to get a sense more of what we're doing over at the Catholic Worker House, you're welcome to pick up one of those. And if you want to be on the newsletter list, you can just sign either your address if you want it mailed or your email if you want it emailed to you. That's there. And then I just want to point out this other brochure that's there. Part of what Catholic Worker does is trying to address some of the reasons for why we have the issues of poverty and marginalization. And one of our passions has been government defense spending, which is greater than all of the countries in the world combined. In our country, we have military bases in something like 1,000 different countries off our soil. The next one, I think, is France has 5 somewhere. So we just spend billions and billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars every year. But Vandenberg, close to us, tests ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. So we made up this little brochure, and I would invite you to just grab one and just read it, just look at it, and you get a sense of our perspective. And that's it. That's the plug I'm going to make.
Thank you both for your presentation. You're both a wonderful combination of what I call the masculine and feminine archetypes. Yes, both of you. And thanks for the story about, is it Alfonso?
story is such a great way to really help people change their minds. And when Father Greg Boyle was here, he had a lot of stories about the gang members. And one thing I remember him saying, and it stuck with me, it's the only thing I remember about what he said that day, was that we shouldn't judge the gang members. Rather, we should be in awe of the burden they carry. And when you tell a story like Alfonso's, you get a sense of the burden that he carried, and it just, the compassion grows for that. So thank you for telling the stories.
Yes, thank you. I'm actually here from the Bay Area, visiting a good friend that lives here in Santa Barbara, and
closer to the mic. And just, I semi-retired about 4 years ago and had always heard about Catholic Worker and had read about Dorothy Day. So I started volunteering there, doing healing work with the homeless mostly. And, but what has really struck me is the presence of so many young people coming up who are are aware of Catholic Worker and who have such enthusiasm for it. And so I guess I'm commending you for your long term, but wanting to know if you have a sense of the Catholic Worker will have a longevity because of these young people who have a dedication. I think certainly anti-war business and politics, but also for those, the homeless. Okay. Goodbye. just a little comment about young people coming into Catholic Worker.
Yeah, so I just want to say I was very young when I met the Catholic Worker, and as a young person, having grown up in Catholic school, there didn't seem to be a lot of options other than religious life. And so meeting the Catholic Worker just sort of like blew both my heart and mind open. And I find that still very much with the youth today, is that part of the dynamism of Catholic Worker is that though there are books written about, and even our founder was a writer, it's really, its essence is in the doing. And young folk all need to do. And so I think that there's an integrity and a real appreciation from the youth when they see the worker and its actions really matching that, as I experienced, to the radical Jesus. So, yes, thank you for saying that. And we're not institutionalized, so we really don't know where and how, even if it's going to continue, but we are confident that the Spirit's lead is in all of it.
So thank you for coming and being so inspirational today. You know, it seems like in a weird way it's so appropriate for Valentine's Day to be moved so deeply by your stories. I did want to comment, because so much of what you were talking about was about jail and prison, that they just had a report on, it's a one-day snapshot. Some of you may have heard about it, but there's like over 600 people in our county jail every day that are there because of mental illness or addiction still. And also that the number of people of that group that exit jail, over 50% return. So we're trying to work on and we're doing some things to help with that. But also, you know, I felt like as you were telling this beautiful story of your experience in jail, of love and community and so on, that's really not a typical experience of people who I think have mental illness or these other things that sit in this cell and have these horrible abuse and neglect that we had our disabilities report share with us about our county. So maybe think about that's a part of it too, you know. And then the last thing, I was kind of humbled this morning. I was, for some reason, thinking about jail and these sentences and hearing about these indictments, and in my heart wishing that these dreadful people people who have done so much abuse of our democracy and so much damage to our country, kind of wanting these indictments to put them in prison forever. And this inclusiveness just is hard for me to include that particular group of people. And we're going to have more and more of this kind of indictments and discussion of prison and wanting to punish, you know, in our future. I see that and wondered what your thoughts are on that.
Hadn't really thought about it. Okay, just to try and break that down a little bit. The first thing about the mentally ill and the addicted in prison. Right now, I'm working with a group called Poetic Justice Project. We put on plays, and the actors in the play are all people who have been released from prison. So the actors have a very intimate knowledge of the prison and the system. And there's lots of issues. The mentally ill should not be in prison. The addicted should not be in prison. We should have programs for that. But the problem is money. It's always money. You know, people come out of prison and they've spent however much time in there being told they're worthless individuals until they internalize it and they come out into a world that also doesn't accept them. And where is there to go but back? So I just think this is part of why this is so important to us. $600 to $800 billion a year we spend on this stuff. I figured out one time, and I don't have it exactly right, but if I took a dollar bill and I put it here, one every second, one, two, three, to do 1 year's defense budget would take 27,000 years of putting a dollar bill down every second. It's mind-boggling. We lose track of how much money that is, and yet we can't make a program for someone to come out of prison so they can feel accepted or learn a job or be back in society, or we can't take someone who has an addiction and give them a program, or we can't take someone who's mentally ill and give them the love and care. A mental illness is an illness. Just like we take care of somebody that breaks an arm or has cancer, why can't we take care of our mentally ill? Because we don't have the will, because it's expensive. But we have all this money that we're willing to throw at stuff like this instead. That's my answer to that. And then the second question was, what about the people who you really have a strong disdain for in our political system, who are corrupt? And I've kind of taken on the thought that it's not them. It's not them. If you have someone who wants to act out like that, all you have to do is say, no, I'm sorry, you can't act out like that. We're not putting you in a position of power. We're not putting you... You can say that, but the problem is that we vote these people in. So it's probably better to take the responsibility ourselves for those kinds of people and say, okay, let's be more careful who we vote for and why we're voting for people, and let's research a little bit, find the kind of people that have our values, and then go to work for them and get those people in. And other people, they're not evil people, they're just sometimes doing some despicable things, but we give them the power to do that. So just maybe take a little bit of the take a little bit of the energy off of let's lock them up and throw away the key to let's not just don't give them a position where they can act out like that. That would be my thought.
I've worked with the homeless because it's my daughter's heartfelt thing, and I've worked with her. It's her project, but I've worked to help her, and I have seen a lot of them and seen the categories that they sort of divide themselves into. I've also found that this city has a great big heart. They are really working very hard to find places for people with addictions and with mental problems to live. But here's the problem that I found. Am I the only one that feels this way? They are not giving these places to what we call the suddenly poor, the people who have never been unable to feed their families or house their families before. They're not addicts, and they're not lazy, and they're not crazy. But they cannot apply. If you want to apply for housing, for that, you have to say you have a substance abuse. And I've known people who have tried to pay doctors to get them to say that they have an abuse problem just so they can have a roof over their heads. I wish that it would all be addressed and not such special attention given to one group. I mean, if you're poor, you're poor. And if you're hungry, you're hungry. And if you need a house, you need a house. Why can't we cover everybody?
I just would like to respond to that because I sense the frustration, and I agree with the frustration. But again, I feel like we try and prioritize based on the funds we're willing to put towards that. And so when the real answer is we need more funding, we need to take care of that. That's one thing. And the second thing I think is in the Catholic worker tradition, there is kind of this perspective called personalism. And personalism is how much can I personally take on to address some of the issues. So I think that's always important that we work really hard to have our government put the resources where the resources need to be, but also that we all individually do what we can, what the issues that we can address personally. I think we should do that. And, you know, we kind of alluded to it when we were talking. There's a point at which you realize that the joy and the gratitude from your acts of personalism toward the other become that pearl of great value, the thing that you would do things you didn't even imagine that you would do because the interior spaciousness and the realization that the gospel really is true makes you just go, okay, I'm gonna stretch a little bit here. So it's a dual thing, but that would be my response.
I want to thank you too for what you've been giving us, and I experience this time together as a very precious time to share stories, as you said before. And I just want to offer a little one that just opened my heart. And it was at the time when we were resettling Vietnamese refugees. So this has nothing to do with the Latino farm workers. This has something to do with people who have to begin from the beginning. And Khung An was one such refugee. He was Cambodian. He was in great danger of being murdered because he wore glasses. He met his wife, future wife, and asked her, "Can you help me get out of Cambodia?" And she said, "Take your glasses off, dress like a peasant, and hold on to my arm, and here we go." And they went to Thailand and applied for refugee status. He was a newspaper editor. He was educated. I didn't get to meet him until he showed up in one of these resettlement houses, and this one happened to be in Columbus, was it? Columbus, Ohio. Boy, revisiting it just is a very emotional thing to me, but what I recall is that I went to there to see if I could help out in some way, and the only language I had in common with many of these people was French, because Indochine, you know, was Indochina, was French. In Le Cambodge, also Cambodia, there was a kind of an institutional imperialistic language that the lucky ones learned. And I just poked my head into a living room and said, "Il y a quelqu'un ici qui parle français?" And yeah, I saw this hand go up. And from that moment on, I took him and bonded with him and helped him. And it's a long story, but this has to do with welcoming the stranger, and it takes many wonderful different forms. I'd love to hear some more stories. Maybe we can tell each other our own stories.
Well, I have a similar story to that. I think when you give and you reach out to people, you really gain a lot more than you give. I mean, it's almost overwhelming sometimes. I retired a few years ago, and I found myself later with some time on my hands, and I said, well, I live near the Wake Center. I'm going to go. Literacy is very important to me. I'll go volunteer at the English as a Second Language classes. Well, the teacher just about hogtied me. She was so desperate for help, but she gave me the ones who knew nothing. They didn't even know how to say thank you or anything. Well, what a mix. One from El Salvador, one from Vietnam, one from Ukraine. They couldn't even talk to each other. And some of them didn't even have the same alphabet. And I said, good Lord, you've got to help me here. I can't even talk to any of these people. But through them, this has been going on since last summer. I started with this group. And they've talked me into coming a second day now. And they just about grab me when I come in the room. They're so desperate to learn, and it is just so thrilling to see when they can count from 1 to 10 without looking at the flashcards, the glow on their faces when I give them the thumbs up. I mean, it's just amazing how much more you get than when you give like that. And they're so inspiring. One young fellow drives his bicycle from Isla Vista up to Turnpike every, you know, all week, 4 days a week, to be in that class. I mean, rain or shine, he's on that bicycle coming. So it's very, very inspiring, and I almost feel guilty that I get more than I give, I think, and it just doesn't seem quite right somehow.
Hello. Get close? Okay. I just wanted to share everyday things when we welcome the stranger. My husband and I have met people at, I guess, bars, where they had musicians that we liked. And one of the occasions, we saw another individual who knew all the words to this band's song. And what we ended up doing after talking to him, he'd come from out of town, inviting him to stay with us the next time the person was in town. And several of my friends, I believe we live in a country that's very fearful. And some of my friends, and we've done this several times in different occasions, and they said, aren't you afraid? You know, aren't you? And I, you know, what if he comes drunk or what if he does this? I said, call the police. You know, the back out, the penalty that he doesn't kill us. I mean, I guess that would be a bad thing. But it's very small. It's very small for taking what many people see as a big risk. So we've had dozens of these stories, and I haven't to date, I read people fairly well, I haven't to date had a bad experience inviting people into our home.
I'm a theoretical person. What I'd like is to ask you to comment sort of theoretically about the last person's talking. I remember as I listened to your stories and I approved, I could tell, limit setting the people who had gone too far. You have to go out of the house till you're sober, blah, 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 blah. But the next day, even the person who had overdrawn on your card, you brought them food. How do you work that out?
I'm just going to tell you sort of my process for what it's worth. The second story was particularly difficult because I really did have a relationship with this woman. She'd come to me many times before in crisis, came to tell me that she was pregnant again with her fourth kid. After having the kid, she brought the baby to me the first place she stopped coming back from the hospital. So there really was a relationship there. And when we figured out that she had done this, like, I really had to grieve. Like, I really had to get in touch with the personal loss, the anger, the real sense of betrayal, because we had a relationship. It wasn't an anonymous person. And I knew that I needed to make the connection. I knew I needed to talk with her, not to demand anything, and not even to shame her. It was to say, look at me, you've hurt me. Not an entity, not a group, not another service place. You hurt me. So when I got to her house, the kids were looking out the window, and I was knocking, and I was imagining that she was telling the kids not to answer the door. And I stayed until she answered the door. And I said, we need to talk, but I don't want to talk in front of the kids. So I asked her to come outside, and I said, how could you do this to us? How could you do this to us? And immediately, she started crying. And she said, I just felt desperate. I felt like I wanted to give my kids toys, which is, in fact, all of the Amazon charges were for toys. She said, I just wanted to give my kids toys. We both started crying because I understood the desire to want to give your kids toys, but I couldn't relate to stealing for it. So the way it ended up, and I said, you've crossed the line, and I cannot now forgive you. And in the sense that from my heart I couldn't forgive her. That I tried to explain that it was okay, that it wasn't that she was being thrown out. I just couldn't so easily forgive her. And I said, I need time. I need to come around. The very next week, it was Dennis who was out. We deliver the food to those who are homebound, and we happen to have an extra bag that week. And Dennis is the one who approached me and said, should we give it to her? And there was a long pause in my heart. A long pause in my heart. I felt like the invitation was there, and that it was for me to decide what to do with it. I felt like I couldn't go drop off the bag, but I felt like it was right to have Dennis do it, and he did. We haven't heard from her, haven't had any communication with her, but this is where I think community is so important, because if I can't forgive, and in this particular moment I couldn't, somebody else could. And I think that that's right. So the person that has a family member who's been murdered shouldn't be the one to forgive the perpetrator. That's just too hard. But shouldn't there be enough community among us so that if I can't do it, maybe somebody else can, and I can almost allow that. Because it's coming, the goodness of God is coming through, even if I can't be the one to put flesh and bones on it. So, that's my experience. Yeah, and it's where we really need one another. We can't be God. Nor should we. And if we can't bring the best of us, then have somebody else help us if we can't do it.
I also want to just add one thing to that is if all of us were to define the other based on the worst thing we ever did, we'd be in a bad space. I certainly wouldn't be standing here, that's for sure. We all have, and so I think in the thought is to, again, not sugarcoat the offense, not pretend that it doesn't hurt, not pretend that we don't feel betrayed, and yet to just stop short of defining this woman by that one act. The forgiveness that you can eventually come to when you, if you're able to get there, is really for yourself. It's for us, you know, to carry around a resentment and a betrayal and stuff. It's very painful, and if we can see an individual who's hurt us, and if we're able to say, but this is not who they are. This is not the sum total of who they are. This is what they did. Yes, it hurt. Yes, it stings. Yes, it's a betrayal. But certainly they're still a child of God. And certainly I know, or this is my firm belief, that God loves that person every bit as much as God loves me. So anyway, it's just there's an element in there. All I'm saying is there's an element in there of really struggling to not define a person by the worst thing they've ever done.
I sort of can't help myself from saying this. It's going to sound like a criticism, but I honestly don't mean it that way, because I admire you people so much and the heart is so important. But you've got to work your head with your heart. What you did was put temptation in the way of that woman who was unable to resist it. Now, I have various workers around my house and a cleaning service that has sometimes different people coming in. And I'm very careful, not because I don't trust them, but because I know what a temptation it would be to somebody who's hungry and needs something so badly. If I leave my watch out on a counter, or a piece of jewelry, or my purse that would be easy to pick up. Don't put temptation in the way of these people who are weak and who may never forgive themselves, who would never steal under ordinary circumstances. That was an impulse on her part. And I'm sure that she is desperately sorry for it and ashamed to face you now after what she's done. So just be careful not to put things in people's way that they are not going to be strong enough to resist. And I'm sorry, I don't mean this to criticize you.
From my own experience,
I have realized, use your head as well as your heart.
So I'll just say this, is that the great temptation for me was to tell Dennis not to say the story, because clearly it puts me in a bad light, because I've been around for 30 years working with an underprivileged group of people. And yes, I know all of those things. And this one time, and probably more than one time, just the one time that's been said, there's probably many more, I didn't think. Clearly, I don't know what I was thinking. I agree with you that we need to not be gullible. And I almost pride myself in feeling that I'm not. However, sometimes in relationship, and don't we all know this, in relationship, sometimes you don't make those clear distinctions. Exactly. Exactly. So I think, and that's really how I've been able to forgive myself, because for days I just like, what was I thinking? And God love Dennis, who is able to provide that for me and forgiveness for myself as I try to forgive myself. But yes, I do think it's important that we not be gullible, and I also know that it's time, right, to stop. So thank you.
Thank you. And isn't it kind of wonderful that we were able to finish on these real meaty dilemmas that we face? This is real stuff. And very important. Okay, well, we thank Dennis and Tensi, as we already have. And next week we will have the Reverend Tim Burnett, who is the curator of the Way Collective, to address our chapters on sacred service and on mercy. So we'll look forward to seeing you next week. Oh, one more thing. Yes.
I just am aware that many people have been very generous today. We have a cart full of disposable diapers, which is like gold where we are. Some people have given us donations. I don't know that we'll be able to thank everybody individually. I want to thank everybody for your warm hospitality and for your gift to us.
Thank you. Thank you.